bringing thousands of women and girls back to the Iron Islands in chains. At 30, he defeated the Lords of the Trident in battle, forcing the River King, Bernard II, to bend the knee and yield up his three young sons as hostages. 3 years later, he put the boys to death with his own hand, cutting out their hearts when their father's annual tribute was late in coming. When their grieving sire went to war to avenge them, King Corrid and his iron men destroyed Bernard's host and had him drowned as a sacrifice to the drowned god, putting an end to House Justman and throwing the Riverlands into bloody anarchy. But after Corrid, a slow decline began. The kings who followed Corrid played a part in that, yet the men of the Greenlands were likewise growing stronger. The first men were building longships of their own, their towns defended by stone walls, in place of wooden palisades and spiked ditches. The gardeners and the high towers were the first to cease paying tribute. When King Theon III Greyjoy sailed against them, he was defeated and slain by Lord Lyman Hightower, the Sea Lion, who revived the practice of thraldom in Oldtown just long enough to set the iron men captured during the battle to hard labor, strengthening the city's walls. The growing strength of the Westlands posed an even more acute threat to the dominion of the Driftwood Kings. Fair Isle was the first to fall, when its small folk rose up under Gilbert Tharman to expel their ironborn overlords. A generation later, the Lannisters captured the town of Case, when Herrick the Horseman blew his great gold-banded horn, and the town halls opened a postern gate to his men. Three successive ironborn kings attempted to retake the prize and failed, two of them dying on the point of Herrick's sword. The ultimate indignity came courtesy of Gerald Lannister, King of the Rock. Gerald the Great, as he is remembered in the West, sailed his own fleet to the Iron Islands themselves in a daring raid, taking 100 ironborn hostages. He kept them in Casterly Rock thereafter, hanging one every time his shores were raided. In the century that followed, a succession of weaker kings lost the Arbor, Bear Island, Flint's Finger, and most of the ironborn enclaves along the Sunset Sea, until only a handful remained. It must not be thought that the Ironborn won no victories during these years. Balin the Fifth Greyjoy, called Coldwind, destroyed the feeble fleets of the King in the North. Eric the Fifth Harlaw retook Fair Isle in his youth, only to lose it again in his old age. His son Heron slew Gareth the Grim of Highgarden, beneath the walls of Oldtown. Half a century later, Joran I Blacktide captured Jarls II Gardener when their fleets clashed off the Misty Islands. After torturing him to death, Joran had his corpse cut into pieces so that he might bait his fishhooks with a chunk of king. Later in his reign, Joran swept across the Arbor with steel and fire, and supposedly carried off every woman on the island under 30 years of age, thereby earning himself the name Maiden's Bane, by which he is best remembered. Yet all these triumphs proved short-lived, along with many of the kings who won them. As the centuries passed, the kingdoms of the Greenlands grew stronger and the Iron Islands weaker. And late in the Age of Heroes, another crisis weakened and divided the Ironborn further still. Upon the death of King Oregon III Grey Iron, Oregon the Bald, his younger sons hurriedly convened a king's moot, whilst their elder brother, Torgon, was raiding up the Mander, thinking that one of them would be chosen to wear the Driftwood crown. To their dismay, the captains and kings chose Orthon Goodbrother of Great Wick instead. The first thing the new king did was command that the sons of the old king be put to death. For that, and for the savage cruelty he oft displayed during his 2 years as king, Orthon the Fourth, good brother, is remembered in history as bad brother. When Torgon Greyon returned at last to the Iron Islands, he declared the king's moot to be invalid, because he had not been present to make a claim. The priests supported him in this, for they had grown weary of bad brother's arrogance and impiety. Small folk and great lords alike rose at their call, rallying to Dorgan's banners, until Orthon's own captains hacked Orthon into pieces. Torgon the latecomer became king in his stead, and ruled for 40 years without ever having been chosen and proclaimed at a king's moot. He proved to be a strong king, just and wise and fair-minded, but he could do little to arrest the declining fortunes of the Iron Islands. For it was during Torgon's reign that most of the Cape of Eagles was lost to the Malisters of Sigurd. Torgon had struck one blow against the institution of the king's moot in his youth, by throwing over its chosen king. In his old age he struck another, calling upon his own son Orgon to help him rule. At court and council, in war and peace, the son remained at his father's side for the best part of 5 years. So when Torgon finally died, it seemed only natural for his chosen heir to succeed him as Orgon the Fourth Greyarn. No king's moot was summoned, and this time no Galen Whitestaff arose in wrath to protest the succession. The final fatal blow against the power of the captains and the kings assembled was dealt when Orgon the Fourth himself died, after a long but undistinguished reign. It had been the dying king's wish that the high kingship passed to his great nephew, Orrin Greyarn, Salt King of Orkmont, known as Orrin Redhand. The priests of the Drowned God were determined not to allow the power of kingmaking to be taken from them for a third time, so word went forth that the captains and kings should assemble on Old Wick for a king's moot. Hundreds came, amongst them the Salt Kings and Rock Kings of the Seven Major Isles, and even the Lonely Light. Yet scarcely had they gathered when Orrin Redhand loosed his axemen on them, and Naga's ribs ran red with blood. 13 kings died that day, and 50 priests and prophets. It was the end of the king's moots, and the Red Hand ruled as High King for 22 years thereafter, and his descendants after him. The wandering holy men never again made and unmade kings as they once had. The Iron Kings. The Grey Irons were amongst the oldest and most renowned of the great houses of the Iron Islands. During the long age of the King's Moot, the captains and kings bestowed driftwood crowns on no fewer than 38 Grey Irons, according to Harrog, giving them twice as many High Kings as any other house. That era ended with Orrin Redhand and the slaughter on Old Wick. Henceforth the crown of the Iron Islands would be made of black iron and would pass from father to son by right of primogeniture. Nor would the Grey Irons suffer any other kings on the isles. There would be no more Salt Kings, no more Rock Kings. Orrin Redhand and his heirs styled themselves simply King of the Iron Islands. The rulers of Great Wick, Old Wick, Pike, Harlaw, and the Lesser Isles were reduced to lords, and several ancient lines were extinguished entirely when they refused to bend their knees. But House Greyarn's grasp upon its iron crown did not go uncontested. Along with the king's moot, Galen Whitestaff's prohibition against the ironborn making war on other ironborn also perished amidst the slaughter on Old Wick. Over the centuries that followed, Orrin Redhand and his successors had to deal with 6 major rebellions and at least 2 major thrall uprisings. Nor were the lords and kings of the mainland slow to take advantage of this disunity amongst the Ironborn. One by one, all the remaining footholds in the Greenlands were lost. The most telling blow was struck by King Garth the Seventh, the Golden Hand, King of the Reach, when he drove the Iron Men from the Misty Islands, renamed them the Shield Islands, and resettled them with his own fiercest warriors and finest seamen to defend the mouth of the Mander. The arrival of the Andals in the Seven Kingdoms only hastened the decline of the Iron Islands, for unlike the first men who had gone before, the Andals were fearless seamen, with long ships of their own as swift and seaworthy as any that the Ironborn could build. As the Andals flooded into the riverlands, the Westerlands on the Reach, new villages sprang up along the coasts, walled towns and stout stone and timber castles rose over every cove and harbour, and great lords and petty kings alike began to build warships to defend their shores and shipping. In due time, the Andals swept over the Iron Islands just as they had all Westeros below the neck. Successive waves of Andal adventurers descended on the islands, oft in alliance with one or another faction of the Ironborn themselves. The Andals intermarried with some of the ancient families of the islands, and brought others to a bloody end with sword and axe. House Greyarn was among those destroyed. The last Iron King, Rognar the Second, was brought down when the Orkwoods, Drums, Hawes, and Greyjoys made common cause against him, supported by a host of Andal pirates, sellswords, and warlords. Afterward, the victors could not agree on who should succeed Rognar as king, so it was decided that they would settle the matter by dancing the finger dance, a game popular amongst the Ironborn, wherein players spin a throwing axe at one another and attempt to snatch it from the air. Harris Hoare emerged as victor at the cost of two fingers. As Harris Stumphand, he ruled the Iron Islands for 30 years.
Many believe the tale of Harris's winning his crown by catching an axe to be no more than a singer's fancy. In truth, Archmaester Hayrig suggests that Harris was chosen because he had taken an Andal maiden for his wife, thereby winning the support of her father and many other powerful Andal lords.
The Black Blood. Archmaester Haik tells us that the kings of House Hoare were black of hair, black of eye, and black of heart. Their foes claim their blood was black as well, darkened by the Andal taint, for many of the early Hoare kings took maidens of that ilk to wife. True Ironborn had salt water in their veins, the priests of the Drowned God proclaimed. The black-blooded Hoares were false kings, ungodly usurpers, who must be cast down. Many tried to do just that over the centuries, as Hayrig relates in some detail. None succeeded. What the Hoares lacked in valor, they made up for in cunning and cruelty. Few of their subjects ever loved them, but many had good reason to fear their wrath. Their very names proclaim their nature to us. Even after the passage of hundreds of years, Wulfgar the Widowmaker, Horgan Priestkiller, Fergan the Fierce, Uthgar the Soulless, Uthgar Demon Lover, Craghorn of the Red Smile, the priests of the Drowned God denounce them all. Were the kings of House Hoare truly as ungodly as these holy men proclaimed? Haik believes they were, but Archmaester Hayrig takes a very different view, suggesting that the true crime of the black-blooded kings was neither impiety nor demon worship, but tolerance. For it was under the Hoares that the faith of the Andals came to the Iron Islands for the first time. Prompted by their Andal queens, these kings granted the scepters and septons their protection, and gave them leave to move about the islands, preaching of the seven. The first sept on the Iron Islands was built on Great Wick during the reign of Wulfgar Widowmaker, when his great-grandson, Horgan, permitted the building of another on Old Wick, where the king's moots had been held of old. The entire island rose up in bloody rebellion, goaded by the priests. The sept was burned, the septon pulled to pieces. The worshippers dragged into the sea to drown, that they might regain their faith. It was in answer to this, Heyrig alleges, that Horgan Hoar began to slaughter priests. The Hoar kings also discouraged the practice of reaving, and as reaving declined, trade grew. There was still a wealth of iron ore to be found beneath the hills of Great Wick, Orkmont, Harlaw and Pike, and lead and tin as well. The iron men's need for wood to build their ships remained as great as ever, but they no longer had the strength to take it wherever they found it. Instead, they traded iron for timber. And when winter came and the cold winds blew, iron ore became the coin the kings of Harz Hoar used to buy barley, wheat, and turnips to keep their small folk fed, and beef and pork for their own tables. Paying the iron price took on a whole new meaning, one many ironborn found humiliating, and the priests decried as shameful. The nadir of ironborn pride and power was reached during the reigns of the three Harmans. On the isles they are best remembered as Harman the Host, Harman the Haggler, and Harman the Handsome. Harman the Host was the first king of the Iron Islands known to be literate. He welcomed travellers and traders from the far corners of the world to his castle on Great Wick, treasured books, and gave septons and scepters his protection. His son, Harman the Haggler, shared his love of reading, and became renowned as a great traveller. He was the first king of the Iron Islands to visit the Greenlands without a sword in his hand. Having spent his youth as a ward of Harse Lannister, the second Harmond returned to Castle Rock as a king and took the Lady Lelia Lannister, a daughter of the King of the Rock and the fairest flower of the West, for his queen. On a later voyage, he visited Highgarden and Oldtown to treat with their lords and kings and foster trade. His own sons were raised in the faith, or King Harman's own peculiar version of it. Upon his death, the eldest of them ascended the throne. Harman the Handsome, influenced, some say, by his Lannister mother, the Dowager Queen Lelia, announced that henceforth reavers would be hanged as pirates, rather than celebrated, and formally outlaw the taking of salt wives, declaring the children of such unions to be bastards with no right of inheritance. He was considering a measure to end the practice of thraldom on the isles as well, when a priest known as the Shrike began to preach against him. Other priests took up the cry, and the lords of the isles took heed. Only the septons and their followers stood by King Harmond, and he was overthrown within a fortnight, almost bloodlessly. What followed was far from bloodless, however. The Shrike himself tore out the deposed king's tongue, so he might never again speak lies and blasphemies. Harmond was blinded as well, and his nose was cut off, so all men might see him for the monster he is. In his place, the lords and priests crowned his younger brother, Hagen. The new king denounced the faith, rescinded Harman's edicts, and expelled the septons and scepters from his realm. Within a fortnight, every sept in the Iron Islands was aflame.
Though Harman II accepted the seven as true gods, he continued to do honour to the drowned god as well, and on his return to Great Wick spoke openly of the eight gods, and decreed that a statue of the drowned god should be raised at the doors of every sept. This pleased neither the septons nor the priests, and was denounced by both. In an attempt to placate them, the king rescinded his decree and declared that God had but seven faces. But the drowned god was one of those, as an aspect of the stranger.
King Hagen, soon to be known as Hagen the Heartless, even permitted the mutilation of his own mother, Queen Lelia the Lannister whore, who was blamed by the Shrike for turning her husband and sons away from the true God. Her lips, ears, and eyelids were cut off and her tongue ripped out with hot pincers, after which she was bundled onto a longship and returned to Lannisport. The King of the Rock, her nephew, was so angered by this atrocity that he called his banners. The war that followed left 10,000 dead, three-quarters of them ironborn. In its seventh year, the Westermen landed on Great Wick, smashed Hagen's host in battle, and captured his castle. Hagen the Heartless was mutilated in the same fashion as his mother before being hanged. Sir Aubrey Crakehall, commanding the Lannister armies, ordered that Hall Castle be razed to the ground. But as his men were looting, they came upon Harman the Handsome in a dungeon. Crakehall briefly considered restoring Harman to his throne, Hayrig claims. But the former king was blind, broken, and half-mad from long confinement. Sir Aubrey granted him the gift of death instead, serving Harman a cup of wine laced with milk of the poppy. Then, in an act of mad folly, the knight decided to claim the kingship of the Iron Islands for himself. This pleased neither the Ironborn nor the Lannisters. When word reached Castle Rock, the king called his warships home, leaving Crakehall to fend for himself. Without the power and wealth of House Lannister to prop him up, King Aubrey saw his power crumble quickly. His reign lasted less than half a year before he was captured and sacrificed to the sea by the Shrike himself. The war between the Ironborn and the Westermen continued in a desultory fashion for five more years, finally ending in an exhausted peace that left the Iron Islands impoverished, burned, and broken. The winter that followed was long and harsh, and is remembered on the Isles as the Famine Winter. Haight tells us that three times as many Iron Men perished of starvation that winter than had died in the battles that preceded it. It would be centuries before the Iron Islands recovered, a long, slow climb back up to prosperity and power. Of the kings who reigned during this bleak age, we need not treat. Many were puppets of the lords or priests. A few were more like the reavers of the Age of Heroes, men such as Harrig Hor and his son, Ravus the Raper, who savaged the north in the years of the Hungry Wolf's bloody reign. But they were rare and far between. Both reaving and trade played a part in the restoration of the pride and prowess of the islands. Other lands now built larger and more formidable warships than the Iron Men, but nowhere were sailors any more daring. Merchants and traders sailing from Lordsport on Pike and the harbours of Great Wick, Harlaw, and Orkmund spread out across the seas, calling it Lannisport, Old Town, and the Free Cities, and returning with treasures their forebears had never dreamed of. Reaving continued as well, but the wolves of the sea no longer hunted close to home, for the Greenland kings had grown too powerful to provoke. Instead, they found their prey in more distant seas, in the Basilisk Isles and the Stepstones, and along the shores of the disputed lands. Some took service as sailsails, fighting for one or another of the free cities in their endless trade wars. One such was Harwin Hoare, third-born son of King Corwin the Conning. A shrewd and avaricious king, Corwin had spent his entire reign accumulating wealth and avoiding war. "War is bad for trade," he said, infamously, even as he was doubling, then tripling, the size of his fleets, and commanding his smiths to forge more armour, swords, and axes. "Weakness invites attack," Corwin declared. "To have peace, we must be strong." His son Harwin had no use for peace, but much and more for the arms and armour that his father forged. A belligerent boy, by all accounts, and third in the succession, Harwin Hoare was sent to sea at an early age. He sailed with a succession of reavers in the Stepstones, visited Volantis, Tyrosh, and Braavos, became a man in the pleasure gardens of Lys, spent 2 years in the Basilisk Isles as a captive of a pirate king, sold his sword to a free company in the disputed lands, and fought in several battles as a second son. When Harwin returned to the Iron Islands, he found his father, Corwin, dying, and his eldest brother 2 years dead from grayscale. A second brother still stood between Harwin and the crown, and his sudden death, even as the king was breathing his last, remains a matter of dispute to this day. Those present at Prince Harlan's passing all declared his death accidental, the result of a fall from his horse. But of course it would have been worth their lives to suggest otherwise. Beyond the Iron Islands, it was widely assumed that Prince Harwin was behind his brother's demise. Some claimed he had done the deed himself, others that Prince Harlan had been slain by a faceless man of Braavos. King Corwin expired 6 days after the Crown Prince, leaving his third-born son to inherit. As Harwin Hardhand, he would soon write his name in blood across the histories of the Seven Kingdoms. When the new king visited his father's shipyards, he declared that long ships are meant to be sailed. When he inspected the royal armories, he announced that swords are made to be blooded. King Corwin had oft-said that weakness invites attack. When his son gazed across Ironman's Bay, he saw only weakness and confusion in the riverlands, where the lords of the Trident chafed restlessly beneath the heel of the Storm King, Eric Durandon, in distant Storm's End. Harwin assembled a host and led it across the bay on 100 of his father's longships. Landing on Challenge north of Seagard, they carried their ships overland to the Blue Fork of the Trident, then swept downstream with fire and sword. A few of the river lords took up arms against them. Most did not, for they had little love and less loyalty for their liege lord in the Stormlands. In those days, the Ironborn were thought to be savage fighters at sea, but easily put to rout on land. But Harwin Hoare was not like other Ironborn. Tempered in the disputed lands, he proved to be as fierce a foot as he was at sea, routing every foe. After he dealt the Blackwoods a crushing defeat, many lords of the Trident declared for him. At Fairmarket, Harwin found himself facing Eric Durandon, the young Storm King, leading a host half again the size of his own. But the Stormlanders were ill-led, weary, and far from home, and the Iron Men and River Lords shattered them. King Eric lost 2 brothers and half his men, and was lucky to escape with his own life. As he fled south, the small folk of the Riverlands rose up, and his garrisons were driven out or slaughtered. The broad, fertile Riverlands and all their wealth passed from the hands of Storm's End to those of the Iron Men. In one bold stroke, Harwin Hardhand had increased his holdings tenfold and made the Iron Islands once more a power to be feared. those lords of the Trident who had joined him in hopes of freeing themselves from the Durandans, soon learned that their new masters were far more brutal and demanding than their old ones. Harwin would rule his conquest with a heavy hand until his death, spending far more time in the riverlands than on the islands, riding from one end of the Trident to the other at the head of a rapacious army, sniffing out any hint of rebellion whilst collecting taxes, tribute, and salt wives. His palace was a tent, his throne a saddle, men said of him. His son Halic, who succeeded to the crown when the Hard Hand died in his 64th year, was a man of the same stripe. Halic visited the Iron Islands only thrice during his reign, spending less than 2 years there all told. Though he called himself Ironborn, sacrificed to the Drowned God, and always kept three priests at his side, there was more of the Trident than of the Salt Sea in Halic Hor, and he seemed to look upon the islands only as a source of arms, ships, and men. His own reign was even bloodier than his father's, if less successful, marked by unsuccessful wars against the Westermen and Stormlanders, and no less than 3 failed attempts to conquer the Vale, all ending in disaster at the Bloody Gate. Like his sire, King Halic spent a great deal of his reign in camp tents on campaign. When not at war, he ruled his broad domains from a modest tower house at Fairmarket in the heart of the Riverlands, near the site of his father's greatest victory. His own son desired a grander seat than that, and would spend most of his own reign building it. But the tale of Héireann the Black and the building of Héireann Hall has been touched upon elsewhere. The dragon flame that destroyed Héireann Hall put a fiery end to King Héireann's dreams, the domination of the Riverlands by the Ironborn and the Black Line of House Hall. The Greyjoys of Pike. The death of Héireann the Black and his sons left the Iron Islands kingless and in chaos. Many great lords and famous warriors had been serving with King Héireann in the Riverlands. Some died with him in the burning of Héireann Hall, others when the Riverlands rose up against them. Only a few reached the coast alive, and fewer still found longships waiting, unburned, to carry them home. Aegon Targaryen and his sisters paid little heed to the Iron Islands in the immediate aftermath of Héireann Hall. They had more pressing concerns, and powerful foes to defeat on every hand. Left to fend for themselves, the Ironborn immediately fell to fighting. Corran Valmark, a minor lord on Harlaw, was the first man to claim the kingship. His grandmother had been a younger sister of Harwin Hardhand. On the basis of that tie, Valmark declared himself the rightful heir of the Black Line. On Old Wick, 20 priests gathered beneath the bones of Naga to place a driftwood crown on one of their own, a barefoot holy man called Lodus, who claimed to be the living son of the Drowned God. Other claimants soon arose on Great Wick, Pike, and Orkmont, and for a full year and more, their followers fought each other by land and sea. Aegon the Conqueror put an end to the fighting in 2 AC when he and Beleriand descended upon Great Wick, accompanied by a vast war fleet. The Iron Man collapsed before him. Corran Valmark died at the Conqueror's own hand, cut down by Aegon's Valyrian steel blade, Blackfyre. On Old Wick, the priest-king, Lodus, turned to his god, calling on the krakens of the deep to drag down Aegon's warships. When the krakens failed to appear, Lodus filled his robes with stones and walked into the sea to take counsel with his father. thousands followed him. Their bloated corpses washed up on the shores of the isles for years to come, though the priest's own body was not amongst them. On Great Wick and Pike, the surviving contenders, the king on Orkmund having been slain the previous year, were quick to bend the knee and do homage to House Targaryen. But who would rule them? On the mainland, some urged Aegon to make the Ironborn vassals to Lord Tully of Riverrun, whom he had named Lord Paramount of the Trident. Others suggested that the islands be given to Casterly Rock. A few went so far as to implore him to scour the islands clean with dragon flame, putting an end to the scourge of the Ironborn for all time. Aegon chose a different course. Gathering the remaining lords of the Iron Islands together, he announced that he would allow them to choose their own Lord Paramount. Unsurprisingly, they chose one of their own, Vicon Greyjoy, Lord Reaper of Pike, a famous captain descended of the Grey King. Though Pike was smaller and poorer than Great Wick, Harlaw, and Orkmont, the Greyjoys boasted a long and distinguished lineage. In the days of the King's Moot, only the Grey Irons and Good Brothers had produced more kings, and the Grey Irons were gone. Exhausted and impoverished by years of war, the Iron Men accepted their new overlord without demur. It took the Iron Islands the best part of a generation to recover from the wounds inflicted by Harren's fall and the fratricidal war that followed. Vicon Greyjoy, enthroned on Pike on the sea stone chair, proved a stern but cautious ruler. Though he did not outlaw reaving, he commanded that the practice be confined to distant waters, far beyond the shores of Westeros, so as not to provoke the wrath of the Iron Throne. And since Aegon had accepted the Seven as his guards and been anointed by the High Septon in Old Town, Lord Vicon allowed the Septons to return to the islands once again to preach the faith. This angered many pious Ironborn, and provoked the wrath of the priests of the Drowned God, as it always had before. "Let them preach," Lord Vicon said, when told of the unrest. "We have need of winds to fill our sails." He was Aegon's man, he reminded his son Goran, and no man but a fool would dare rise against Aegon Targaryen and his dragons. These were words that Goran Greyjoy would remember. When Lord Vicon died in 33 AC, Goran succeeded him as Lord of the Iron Islands, putting down a clumsy conspiracy to restore the Black Line by crowning Corran Volmark's son in his stead. He faced a more serious test 4 years later, when Aegon the Conqueror died of a stroke on Dragonstone, and his son Aenys was crowned king in his stead. Though amiable and well-meaning, Aenys Targaryen was widely perceived as a weakling, unfit to sit the Iron Throne. The new king was still on his royal progress when rebellions began to break out all across the realm. One such revolt convulsed the Iron Islands, led by a man claiming that he was the priest King Lodus, returned at last from visiting his father. But Goran Greyjoy dealt with it decisively, going so far as to send the priest king's pickled head to Aenys Targaryen. His grace was so pleased with the gift that he promised Lord Goran any boon that was within his power to grant. As sage as he was savage, Greyjoy asked the king to give him leave to expel the Septons and Scepters from the Iron Islands. King Aenys was forced to agree. A century would pass before another Sept was opened on the islands. For long years afterward, the Ironborn remained quiescent under a succession of Greyjoy lords. Eschewing further thoughts of conquest, they lived by fishing, trade, and mining. All the width of Westeros lay between King's Landing and Pike, and the Ironborn had little and less to do with affairs at court. Life was hard upon the islands, especially in winter, but that was as it had always been. Some men still dreamed of a return to the old way, when the Ironborn were a people to be feared. But the Stepstones and the summer sea were far away, and the grey joys on the sea-stone chair would allow no reaving closer to home. The Red Kraken. The better part of a century would pass before the Kraken woke. Yet the dreams never died, for the priest still stood knee-deep in the salt sea, preaching of the old way. Whilst in 100 wharfside brothels and sailors' taverns, old men still told tales of days gone by, when the Ironborn were rich and proud, and every oarsman had a dozen salt wives to warm his bed by night. Many a boy and young man grew drunk upon such stories, hungry for the glories of the reaver's life. One such was Dalton Greyjoy, the wild young son of the heir to Pike and the Iron Islands. Of him Hake writes, "He loved three things, the sea, his sword, and women. A fearless child, headstrong and hot-tempered, he is said to have been rowing at 5 and reaving at 10, sailing with his uncle to the Basilisk Isles to raid the pirate towns for plunder. By the age of 10 and 4, Dalton Greyjoy had sailed as far as Old Gis, fought in a dozen actions, and claimed 4 salt wives. His men loved him, more than can be said of his wives, for he tired of women quickly. His own love was his blade, a Valyrian steel longsword he had taken off a dead corsair and named Nightfall. In his 15th year, whilst fighting in the Stepstones as a sail-sail, he saw his uncle slain, and avenged his death, but he took a dozen wounds, and emerged from the fight, drenched from head to heel in blood. From that day forth, men called him the Red Kraken. Later that same year, word of his father's death reached him in the Stepstones, and the Red Kraken claimed the sea-stone chair as the lord of the Iron Islands. At once he began building longships, forging swords, and training fighters. When asked why, the young lord replied, "The storm is coming." The storm he had foreseen broke the next year, when King Viserys the First Targaryen died in his sleep in the Red Keep of King's Landing. His daughter Rhaenyra and her half-brother Aegon both laid claim to the Iron Throne, and the orgy of bloodletting, battle, rapine, and murder known as the Dance of the Dragons began. When word reached Pike, the Red Kraken is said to have laughed aloud. Throughout the war, Princess Rhaenyra and her blacks enjoyed a great advantage at sea, for amongst her supporters was Corlys Velaryon, Lord of the Tides, the fabled Sea Snake, who commanded the fleets of House Velaryon of Driftmark. Hoping to counter that, the Green Council of King Aegon II reached out to Pike, offering Lord Dalton a place on the small council as Lord Admiral of the Realm if he would bring his longships around Westeros to do battle with the Sea Snake. It was a handsome offer, and most boys would have leapt at it. But Lord Dalton had a shrewdness rare in one so young, and elected to wait to see what Princess Rhaenyra might offer. When her missive came, it was much more to his liking. The blacks did not need him to sail his fleet around Westeros to give battle in the narrow sea, a chancy proposition at best. The princess asked only that he attack her enemies. Amongst those enemies were the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, whose lands were close to home and vulnerable. Lord Jason Lannister had taken most of his knights, archers, and seasoned fighters east with him to attack Rhaenyra's allies in the Riverlands, leaving the Westerlands thinly defended. Lord Dalton saw opportunity. Whilst Lord Jason fell in battle in the Riverlands, and his host staggered from battle to battle under a succession of commanders, the Red Kraken and his Ironborn fell upon the Westerlands like wolves upon a flock of sheep. Castle Rock itself proved too strong for them, once Lord Jason's widow, Joanna, barred its gates. But the Iron Men burned the Lannister fleet and sacked Lannisport, carrying off vast amounts of gold, grain, and trade goods, and seizing hundreds of women and girls as salt wives, including the late Lord Jason's favorite mistress and their natural daughters. Further raids and depredations followed. All up and down the western coast, the longship sailed, raiding as they had in days of old. The Red Kraken himself led the attack that captured Case. Faircastle fell, and with it, Fair Isle and all its wealth. Lord Dalton claimed four of Lord Farman's daughters as salt wives, and gave the fifth, the homely one, to his brother, Beren. For the better part of 2 years, the Red Kraken ruled the Sunset Sea, as his forebears had done of old, whilst elsewhere in Westeros great armies marched and clashed, and dragons wheeled across the skies and met in bloody battle. All wars must end, however, and so it was with the Dance of the Dragons. Princess Rhaenyra died, and then King Aegon II. By that time, most of the Targaryen dragons were dead as well, along with scores of lords, both great and small, hundreds of valiant knights, and tens of thousands of common men and small folk. The remaining blacks and greens agreed to terms, and Rhaenyra's young son was crowned as King Aegon III, and wed to Aegon II's daughter, Jaehaera. Peace in King's Landing did not mean peace in the West, however. The Red Kraken had not lost his appetite for battle. When the Council of Regents, ruling in the name of the new boy king, commanded him to cease his raiding, he continued as before. In the end, it was a woman who would prove the Red Kraken's undoing. A girl known to us only as Tess opened Lord Dalton's throat with his own dagger as he slept in Lord Farman's bedchamber in Fair Castle, then threw herself into the sea. The Red Kraken had never taken a rock wife. His closest heirs were his salt sons, young boys fathered on various of his salt wives. Within hours of his death, a bloody struggle for succession broke out. And even before the battles began on Old Wick and Pike, the small folk of Fair Isle rose up and slaughtered those Iron Men who still remained among them. In 134 AC, Lady Joanna Lannister took her revenge for all that the Red Kraken had inflicted on her and hers. With her own fleets destroyed, she persuaded Sir Leo Costaine, the aged Lord Admiral of the Reach, to deliver her swordsmen to the Iron Islands. Embroiled in their own war of succession, the Ironborn were taken unawares. Thousands of men, women, and children were put to the sword. Scores of villages and hundreds of longships put to the torch. Ultimately, Costain was slain in battle, his host largely scattered and destroyed. Only a portion of his fleet, laden with the spoils of war, including many tons of grain and saltfish, returned to Lannisport. But amongst the highborn captives they brought back to Castle Rock was one of the Red Kraken's salt sons. Lady Joanna had him gelded and made him her son's fool. "A fine fool," he proved, Archmaester Hayrig observes, "yet not half so foolish as his father." In other lands, a lord who brought such a fate upon his house and people, would be justly reviled. But such is the nature of the Ironborn of the Isles, that the Red Kraken is revered amongst them to this day, and counted as one of their great heroes. The Old Way and the New. From that day to this, the Lord Reapers of House Greyjoy have ruled the Iron Islands from the Sea Stone Chair on Pike. None since the Red Kraken has posed a true threat to the Seven Kingdoms or the Iron Throne, but few can truly be described as leal and faithful servants of the Crown. Kings they were in days gone by, and even the passage of 1,000 years cannot erase the memory of a driftwood crown. A full account of their reigns can be found in Archmaester Herrig's History of the Ironborn. Therein you may read of Dagon Greyjoy, the last reaver, whose long ships harried the western coasts, when Ares the First Targaryen sat the Iron Throne. Of Alton Greyjoy, the holy fool, who sought new lands to conquer beyond the lonely light. Of Torwin Greyjoy, who swore a blood oath with bitter steel, then betrayed him to his enemies. Of Loren Greyjoy, the bard, and his great and tragic friendship with young Desmond Mallister, a knight of the Green Lands. Near the end of Heyrig's great work, you will come to Lord Kellan Greyjoy, the wisest of the men to sit the Sea Stone Chair since Aegon's conquest. A huge man, 6.5 feet tall. He was said to be as strong as an ox and as quick as a cat. In his youth he earned renown as a warrior, fighting corsairs and slavers in the summer sea. A leal servant of the Iron Throne, he led 100 longships around the bottom of Westeros during the War of the Ninepenny Kings, and played a crucial role in the fighting around the Stepstones. As Lord, however, Kellan preferred to walk the road of peace. He forbade reaving, save by his leave. He brought maesters to the Iron Islands by the score, to serve as healers to the sick and tutors to the young. With them came their ravens, whose black wings would tie the isles to the green lands tighter than ever before. It was Lord Kellan who freed the remaining thralls and outlawed the practice of thraldom on the Iron Islands. In this he was not wholly successful. And whilst he took no salt wives himself, he allowed other men to do so, but taxed them heavily for the privilege. Kellan Greyjoy sired 9 sons and 3 wives. His first and second wives were rock wives, joined to him with the old rites by a priest of the drowned god. But his last bride was a woman of the Greenlands, a piper of Pink Maiden Castle, wed to him in her father's hall by a septon. In this, as in much else, Lord Kellan turned away from the ancient and insular traditions of the Ironborn in hopes of forging stronger bonds between his own domains and the rest of the Seven Kingdoms. So strong a lord was Kellan Greyjoy that few dared speak openly against him, for he was known to be strong-willed and stubborn and fearsome in his wrath. Kellan Greyjoy still sat the Sea Stone Chair when Robert Baratheon, Eddard Stark, and John Arryn raised their banners in rebellion. Age had only served to deepen his cautious nature, and as the fighting swept across the Greenlands, his lordship resolved to take no part in the war. But his sons were relentless in their hunger for gain and glory, and his own health and strength were failing. For some time his lordship had been troubled by stomach pains, which had grown so excruciating that he took a draught of milk of the poppy every night to sleep. Even so, he resisted all entreaties until a raven came to Pike with word of Prince Rhaegar's death upon the Trident. These tidings united his 3 eldest sons. The Targaryen were done, they told him, and House Greyjoy must needs join the rebellion at once or lose any hope of sharing in the spoils of victory. Lord Kellan gave way. It was decided that the Ironborn would demonstrate their allegiance by attacking the nearest Targaryen loyalists. Despite his age and growing infirmity, his lordship insisted on commanding the fleet himself. 50 longships assembled off Pike and bent oars toward the reach. The greater part of the Ironborn fleets remained at home to guard against Lannister attack, for it was not yet known whether Castle Rock would side with the rebels or the royalists. Little and less need be said of Kellan Greyjoy's final voyage. In the histories of Robert's Rebellion, it is no more than an afterthought, a sad and bloody business that had no impact upon the final outcome of the war. The Ironborn sank some fishing boats and captured a few fat merchantmen, burnt some villages, and sacked a few small towns, but at the mouth of the Mander they met unexpected resistance from the Shield Islanders, who sallied forth in their own longships to give battle. A dozen ships were seized or sunk in the fight that followed. And though the Ironborn gave worse than they got, amongst their dead was Lord Kellan Greyjoy. By that time, the war was all but done. Prudently, his heir, Balon Greyjoy, chose to return to his home waters and claim the Seastone Chair. The new Lord of the Iron Islands was Lord Kellan's eldest surviving son, a child of his second marriage, the sons of his first marriage all having died in youth. In many ways he was like his sire. At 13 he could run a longship's oars and dance the finger dance. At 15 he spent a summer in the Stepstones, reaving. At 10 and 7 he was captain of his own ship. Though he lacked his father's size and brute strength, Balon Greyjoy had all his quickness and skill at arms, and no man could question his courage. Yet even as a child, Lord Balon had burned to free the Ironborn from the yoke of the Iron Throne and restore them to a place of pride and power. Once seated on the Seastone Chair, he swept away many of his Lord Father's decrees, abolishing the taxes on salt wives and declaring that men taken captive in war could indeed be kept as thralls. Though he did not expel the Septons, he increased the taxes on them tenfold. The maesters he kept, for they had proved themselves too useful to forsake. Whilst he did put Pike's own maester to death for reasons that remain somewhat obscure, Lord Balon immediately petitioned the citadel for another. Lord Kellan had spent most of his long reign avoiding war. Lord Balon began at once preparing for it. For more than gold or glory, Balon Greyjoy lusted for a crown. This dream of crowns has seemed to haunt House Greyjoy throughout its long history. Oft as not, it ends in defeat, despair, and death, as it did for Balon Greyjoy. For 5 years he prepared, gathering men and longships, and building a great fleet of massive warships with reinforced hulls and iron rams, their decks bristling with scorpions and spitfires. The ships of this iron fleet were more galleys than longships, larger than any that the Iron Men had built before. In 289 AC, Lord Balon struck, declaring himself the King of the Iron Islands and dispatching his brothers Euron and Victarion to Lannisport to burn the Lannister fleet. "The sea shall be my moat," he declared, as Lord Tywin's ships went up in flames, "and woe to any man who dares to cross it." King Robert dared. Robert Baratheon, the first of his name, had won everlasting glory on the Trident. Swift to respond, the young king called his banner